Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Right now at Safeway, save on all your favorite home scents and cleaning products for a fresh, clean home. Shop for deals on items like Glade candles and plug-ins, Febreze air fresheners, Clorox cleaners, Swiffer wet cloths, or Scotch-Brite sponges. Plus, deck the halls and shop for deals on items like mini light sets, holiday wrapping paper, holiday candles, and holiday cards. Offer expires December 26th. Restrictions apply. Promotions may vary. Visit Safeway.com for full offer details.
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
In the mid-80s, Baloui Sum had hits on both sides of the Atlantic, with Imagination and Some People. Born Neville Keithley, his route to success was anything but overnight. In part one of this two-part interview, he talks about his early life, how he honed his songwriting craft, and the near misses he had before his eventual success. A charming and affable man, this is a real insight into the drive and courage it took to achieve that success. Neville Keighley, Baloui Sum, welcome. Actually, you just mentioned it, this email that you sent me, and I was thinking earlier, I knew I'd met you, and I'm actually getting closer to where we must have met, because you mentioned Mark Booth, who was the managing director of MTV, who was a good friend of yours, and Christiana Backer, who was one of the presenters.
All of you. I knew all of you really well, but I had hair. And you know, it's very different when you're 30 years on or 40 years on and you've got no hair. So, I mean, you look still similar. I can look completely different. So it'll come back to you in a minute. But Mark Booth was one of my, he still is one of my best mates. I'm godfather to his children. And right at the beginning, I remember coming out to your Camden place all the time. And going out in those days with Christiana and Mark, you know, 4 nights a week. So I remember we met all those wonderful parties.
That's what I was going to say, because I knew MTV had some brilliant parties, didn't it, at the beginning?
The best.
Amazing.
Yes.
I know, they were completely wild. So and if you remember, one of those.
Steve Fagnoli as well was around, Prince's manager. He was in our gang, and we used to go out. And you were there. I remember there was one over in Westwood Studios, and there was one. Anyway. We don't want to hear about the parties, but we know each other.
We do, we do. So listen, we're born in the same year as well. So we have this sort of growing up in Britain in common. You're from South London. I'm from Chelmsford, which is northeast of London. But, you know, London, the centre of London would have been, you know, the attraction for us
when we were young. But I want to talk about the earlier times and just ask you, what sort of music did your parents listen to, and when did your tastes diverge?
Well, funny enough, there was no music really in my house. My mother brought us up, and she wasn't really very musical. But I went to boarding school where there was every kind of music, and all the big boys, and it was a mixed boarding school. But I remember the guy, everyone was into music, because in those days, as you know, there was nothing else. I mean, it was music or nothing. And so you have quite a diverse taste, a lot of heavy rock, and everyone had, you know, there was one guy I remember who was expelled for plugging his electric guitar into the chapel sound system in the middle of the night, and the whole area listening to this blasting. No, so it was pretty full on music. But I was, 71, 72, David Bowie was my thing, and then all the Roxy music and everything. But of course, I loved, there was so much of it. You know, if you think Jethro Tull, even the heavier stuff, the original Genesis, the, everything, there was so much music, wasn't there?
I'll come to the music in a second, but I just want to ask you, because I know that both my brothers were sent to boarding school. One wanted to go, the other one was a sort of rebellious, had masses of fights in school, and I think my mum just wanted to get him somewhere else. Did you feel actually that your parents had pushed you away? Because I've read a lot about young people, when they go to boarding school, it sort of breaks the umbilical cord to the parents earlier than later.
Oh, it definitely does that. It definitely does. Once you send your kids to boarding school, they've got another agenda. I mean, even now, I see that with my friends who send their kids to boarding school. You are making a decision, and the kids are going to still love you, and they're still going to come home all the time, because in those days, we didn't come home all the time. But there, you are making a decision, and school becomes their life. Sorry, anyone listening who is thinking about... I haven't sent mine to boarding school, but I don't need to, you know, so, but you're absolutely right.
Also, parenting is different. I mean, you're a parent, you've got two young girls, I think.
Yeah.
And parenting is much different. Back then, I think parenting didn't really exist as a term, did it? You know, my father didn't know what school I went to. I mean, he didn't really have any contact to my father at all. Yeah. And it was quite a sort of odd thing today to think that would happen. Were your parents very involved in your
life? My mother was. My father wasn't. He left when I was three, and my brother was a baby. But so it was my brother, my mother brought us up, and it was quite a lot for her to bring up two boys. I mean, remember, boys are always fighting, and in the 70s they were difficult. So I was sent to boarding school. My brother got a scholarship to Allains in South London. He was super clever. So he went on and did great academic things, and I just was on the rampage from the age of 10. Now, thinking about it, 10's very young, but I didn't think I was young at 10. I thought I had it under control. So, probably I wouldn't send a kid to school at 10, but I went, you know, I loved it.
You mentioned Bowie and getting into Bowie, which is something that we, you know, of, I'm going to say of our age, but it's actually across these generations, actually. Yeah. Yeah. But definitely of our age, that Bowie was the phenomena. And for me, he represented, you know, like Bowie was the alien, the other, and he sort of represented my route out of the life that I was in. What was he for you?
Well, the same, because it's the first thing you hear. You see, if you think about it, we're the same age. So about 12, suddenly you hear, and you're aware of music. I mean, the first thing I heard was David Bowie. I mean, Starman. I mean, there are other things around me because the older kids, but this just jumped out. I remember Starman on the radio and thinking, this is just the most incredible thing I've ever heard. I mean, or been a part of. And it makes you dream, and it makes you go off and be in another world. And so then I was hooked. I had to, you know, eventually write songs and whatever. But you're absolutely right. But Bowie was very special time. And if you go back to kids a bit older than us, theirs was heavy rock, you know, and, you know, it's the thing that sparks you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, with Bowie, I mean, I remember I can, you know, recite practically all the lyrics about the first five albums.
Everything. Yeah.
Did you also look at who were making the records at that point?
Or did of course that come I did. Later? Of course I did. I knew everything about everyone. And that's why when I finally got to New York and started finally making my album properly again, remaking it from the first time, I knew these people's inside leg measurement. Yes, I did, because it was so important. I wanted to know how he made his records and where he made them and what was influencing. I wanted to know everything. And like you, I knew every lyric up until Let's Dance. And then after Let's Dance, I think that, by that stage, I'd sort of met him. I had met him, and I was working with the people that he had been working with. So I don't, you know, I wasn't so interested in the next albums. It was, I had my own path, you know.
Now, was it Bowie that sort of inspired you to pick up a guitar and write songs, or to just, you know, just to sort of get into music at an early age?
I don't say it was actually Bowie. I mean, I learned the guitar with, it was a route, it was an escape. I don't know, it's an escape route. I wasn't going to do anything academic. I wanted to be theatrical. I wanted to be in show business, and I had a Beatles songbook, and I learned the guitar with the Beatles songbook. And I recommend that to any kid who wants to learn the guitar. Get the Beatles, you know, songbook, and that'll teach you easily how to learn the guitar. You don't need to be clever, you know. And so I started with that, and I wasn't so interested in playing David Bowie's songs, because I didn't want to copy David Bowie. I wanted to be my own thing, you know. I was never interested in being a clone of anyone, really, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. When you were 18, you left school, and that must have been something like 77, that sort of the early punk era.
Yeah, 77, 78, I think, end of 70.
Well, did you also leave home at that point?
No, I never saw that point. I didn't have any money. I mean, the thing is, I lived in South London anyway. So, I didn't leave home until I was, you know, much later, because I then, you know, eventually started traveling and playing and touring and things like that. And my poor mother, you know, I always remember my mother gave up smoking and drinking the month I left home, which I always thought was... And I didn't realize until about a year later, she wasn't smoking, wasn't drinking. I was like, what the hell? Yes, I think that's probably quite telling, isn't it? No, I didn't leave home. No, I had no money. And of course, I left school, you know, armed with a load of songs. By this stage, I was going to record companies and A&R men with my guitar. I couldn't afford demos. And it wasn't working. So it took another 2 or 3 years afterwards before anyone started to listen seriously to me. No, I had no money, and it was really hard, actually, because everyone writes you off.
But that era is a very interesting era, because the late 70s and we go in and the early 80s, going from an era which had, okay, we had like the 3-day week where we had no power in the mid 70s, I think that was, or 73, 75. And then a bit later, there's you know, mass unemployment, there's then racism. There's misogyny, homophobia, you know, I mean, it has the whole works, but there is also group of subculture, which in a way went round all those things. Were you in that sort of
subculture? No, I was really bad at it. I mean, I was, it's sort of like, I was aware of it. I mean, I was a painter and decorator. I was a landscape gardener, a minicab driver, all just to make enough money to rehearse the band or to do the demo. I wasn't a passionate, sorry, Paul Weller, you know, or whatever. I wasn't angry. I had my own agenda. I sort of skirted round it, like you said. I mean, I wasn't from Birmingham, so I didn't dress up as a new romantic. I wasn't. I just carried on. Solo artist called Neville Keighley writing nice songs, which of course is doomed, you know, absolutely doomed. You're never going to get anywhere, you know.
So when you're saying you're writing nice songs, what, when you went to the record companies, I mean, this is quite a long period, wasn't it? A period of about 4 years where you're really trying to make it. I just wondered what you learned in that period and what you learned from rejection.
Well, it toughened me up. You know, I mean, when I left school, I thought it would be 6 months I'd have a record deal, you know, and of course it was, my first record came out when I was about 5 years later, but it toughened me up. It made me go home and learn my skill. I had no choice. I mean, you sit there and you write from 8 a.m. until, you know, 1 a.m. and you know, because I was living at home. I was under a lot of pressure, you know, no money, blah, 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 odd jobs. So I tried to get my skill, sort my skill, learn songs. So I'd go to see publishers. They'd say, yeah, much better, Neville. you know, what are you talking about? And then I go home and get another appointment 6 months later with another one. It was soul destroying, but I was luckily, I was young and so stupid, I had no idea how tough it was, you know?
What did you specifically learn then? You said it hardened you up, but what did these rejections and also what you were doing, what did you really learn for life, do you think?
Well, you know, the thing is, the first thing is, it's really important, the innocence of youth. I mean, ignorance, innocence, I don't know what it was. I mean, I sat there and I went home, right, okay, what's Bruce Springsteen done? Well, he's written a song like that, so I'd write a Bruce Springsteen song. And what's Elton John done? So I'd write an Elton John song. I mean, I wrote and wrote and wrote, and that is the key to everything. It's the more you write, the better you get. And there's no way around that. Don't think about productions and don't, I never thought about productions or anything. I just thought, does the song work? Does it flow? It's all about the song. And I wrote them all on acoustic guitar. So they had to work because the melodies, if they weren't strong, they wouldn't stand out. And so, you know, Imagination I wrote when I was 19, you know, it didn't come out until I was 24, 25. So that gives you an idea. So it's just about working. You can't do it on a Mac. I worked with a management company about 20 years ago, and you know, they get all these DVDs, CDs would come in, and, you know, I wrote this song last week and I know it's a hit, you know, really? Because it doesn't work like that, does it?
What about Lose It To You? Because that was the first song you recorded, I think, which is actually, I just watched it this morning on YouTube. You can, the record's on there and you can.
I haven't heard it.
All right.
For 40 years. No, I the only reason I know about it is because someone added it to my Wikipedia about 6 months ago. I must listen to it. I'm saying, it sounds pretty horrible, doesn't it?
I don't think so at all. I mean, I think it's identifiable, but it's not completely, it's not, I mean, I know it's under the name Neville Rowe, but it's not Baluie Sum, as you know, we would get to know Baluie Sum, but it's definitely on the way. And I just wonder, because even with that, you know, you worked with people who were still, I would say,
Roland and Kirk.
Maybe not at the time. Yeah, Roland and Kirk.
Well, they weren't at my league at the time. They were in graduate, and they were, and they were with the same publishing company of mine, and they were groveling around like me. I mean, graduate, they had a couple of singles, I think, on Polydor. I don't want to offend any graduate fans. It certainly wasn't Tears for Fears, you know. But Manny was a great drummer, and Roland and Kirk were great. And they had the thing is, I got an, Darren Hatch helped me produce it, or produced it. And he had a connection in Bath. Because they were all from Bath, you see. So we went trundling off to Bath. I've completely forgotten all this, by the way. And David Lord produced it with Darren. And all the musos were down. They all played on it. I think they played on the demo for Imagination as well later on. But I switched off to music, remember, for 30 years. So it's all...
They were all musicians who were on the up.
Yes. You know, well, they weren't on the up then. They weren't Tears for Fears then. All right, I'm sorry to dampen your enthusiasm. They were like me, groveling around with great, great ideals, all thinking they were going to change the world, to coin a phrase. But we hadn't actually got to that stage yet.
So what were your expectations at the time?
Change the world like them. But I mean, and of course, and you have this incredible confidence that, you know, you really are. This is it. This is it. Lose It To You was it, you know. And I probably felt I was more up than them at the time because I was recording a single and they weren't.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
But they were great guys, and I still see Kurt, once at Blue Moon, and Darren, and yeah, it was all part of the process.
Yeah, talking about that process, because to be honest, I mean, the chorus in that is brilliant. I mean, I actually really liked it. So I'm like, this morning. And I think it's because I had a different expectation, because I thought, okay, this must be like the first attempt, and it's the one where he's going, oh God, I don't, you know, this isn't what I want to do or want to be. But actually, you can really feel that there's...
I'm very flattered.
The chorus is really good.
I'm very flattered. Thank you. I'm going to have a listen. But the thing is that, but realistically, I wouldn't have had Roland, Kurt, Manny, Darren, David Lord had done the Corgis and had worked a lot with, you know, Genesis, Peter Gabriel. I was working with good people. So I'm assuming that they lifted my song to their level.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I'm also assuming that they also saw something in you, whether you say it today or not. They obviously saw something in you, otherwise they wouldn't have bothered. I mean, people don't bother when they don't believe in something at all. So
I don't think they were paid. They weren't paid. So, I mean, they didn't have any money. So they must have done it for the right reasons, yeah.
When that record came out, what did you learn from it about your style, your look, the way you performed, the way you sung, that you could change?
Well, I don't think that I deliberately, I think I was back to writing, but the good thing was that I think other people started doing demos with me and getting me studio time, and I was starting to move to the next level of people taking me a bit more seriously. I mean, I still looked like Neville Rowe. I still had curly, you know, normal hair, and I wasn't a rock and roll star, but I was, you know, I was completely unstoppable. You know, nothing would stop me. I would do anything to get to the next level. And so if there was an opportunity, I would take it. And this would probably leading towards the big moment when, I mean, I had another single out, I think called Wartime, that no one ever heard. But then Steve Elson, who was a good songwriter, is a great songwriter, Paul Harrison, the keyboard player from the Corgis, and started doing demos with these guys. And at the same time as if you want me to carry on talking, I'll tell you what happened. I had an aunt who lived in a cottage in the middle of nowhere in North Wales, she was a bit of an alcoholic. And so I'd go up there and do some work on her house occasionally. She was a very eccentric lady. And my brother and I would go up there and she'd pay us. Basically, she, you know, bunged us some money to do painting and, you know, she had some cash and whatever. And one day she said, well, you're pretty useless at doing what you're doing because you've been doing it for 3 years and nothing's happened. What do you need? And I said, well, I'm a solo artist. I need a band. Well, how much does a band cost? I said, I don't want to be in a band because I'd had auditioned loads of bands and they'd always gone wrong. So I said, well, I've got to pay them for the rehearsal time. I've got to pay them. And she wrote a check for like £500, which was a fortune in those days. You know, I was like, you could buy a car, go on holiday for 3 months and, you know, do up the house on that, couldn't you? But it was a fortune. So, and then, you know, at a later stage, she bung me some more money. So I came back to London. I knew what to do, put my band together and went out to try and get gigs. The band sounded amazing. The songs had been honed. You say Lose It To You. This is a couple of years on. So you're talking about a lot of the songs that are on the first album. They were played out, rehearsed every day for a month with this young band. The band looked amazing. And I had a whole load of gigs lined up. And the first problem was, the big problem was, I didn't have a name. So this brings me to the Bluey Sum thing. I was still Neville Keighley, and everyone was like, you can't be Neville Keighley. It's a ridiculous name. Solo artist doesn't work. You're not a band, so you've got to come up with a name. Neville Rowe, you know. So, well, I thought, and it was just, I was 2 weeks away from the first gig, you know, in the Embassy Club. So it was the Bluey something band, but I never got the Blues Brothers was out and the Kinsman song Louie Louie was in it. And I mean, you know, I was clawing every direction, and it was Bluey Sum. That's the name. That's what happened. There's nothing, you know. The other, the divine moment was, I went on stage with my hair like this and froze at the first gig, which was a place called Monkbury's in German Street. And so afterwards, everyone said, you know, that was terrible. You're terrible on stage. You've got no stage craft. You're the worst. You've got to do something. And
Please, wait a minute. Who said that to you?
With the whole, everyone. I mean, most of the audience were friends. This is the worst gig we've ever been to. I just stood there. I froze. So at the same time as Blade Runner had just come out, and, you know, it's very striking. It's now it's common last, but, you know, those days to have white hair was really strange. So I had a girlfriend and she knew a hairdresser. And I sat there for 8 hours while they dyed my hair white. You know, it went yellow, it went green. Eventually it came out white. My eyebrows, everything. And I went home and, you know, people don't recognize you. You looked, I mean, just imagine, there's no one with white hair in those days. I mean, Billy Idol had a sort of, but he wasn't really, you know, he was an American. He wasn't, I mean, it wasn't really in our zone. So I had white hair, a new name, and two or three shots of vodka. And I went on stage as Bluey Sum, and that was it. And then, you know.
Who approached who with the Barrow brothers, the ones that were looking after Duran Duran? Did you approach them or they approach you?
But at this stage, things are starting to sort of be a bit more, people are starting to be a bit more interesting. But the great thing was that the Embassy Club, we had the first gig, and my manager at the time lived opposite a school somewhere in Hertfordshire. And we were much younger, and he was chummy with the sixth formers, and he rented a coach and put a couple of cases of beer on the coach. And so for the first gig at the Embassy Club, there was a big bundle of kids outside. There was a crowd. So the record companies that we'd managed to get along, including, I think, the guy who worked for the Barrow Brothers, not the actual Barrow Brothers at that stage, they couldn't get into the gig. You know, someone had to go out and get them in because there were so many people at the, you know, there was 100 kids there at the Embassy Club. Only took 200 or something ridiculous. So there was a perception that it was time, you know, it was my window to get a record deal. And there were a couple of A&R men there, you know, some love it, some hate it. But I was off and running. And then, you know, within sort of 6 or 7 months, and then the Barrows were like, ooh, what's this? They came down and they liked the songs. And that was the next level, you know, next stage.
What did they promise you?
Well, they were very, very powerful at the time. I mean, they were managing Duran Duran. And to anyone listening to this, Duran Duran were the biggest band in the world. You know, they had number one albums in America, UK, all around the world. They were on their, right at the top of their, they were on their way right up. And there was a tour coming up the following year. And their idea was to, you know, put me on support for the tour in the States. But it didn't happen because my record wasn't ready. My record turned out, my first attempt at the album was a disaster for lots of different reasons. So it wasn't ready, so it didn't happen. But they were very supportive. I mean, they were really supportive because they were song people. So Paul and Michael, they weren't interested in, they were just like, get the songs right, you know?
Fascinating because, you know, Target Practice that came out wasn't, really, yeah. You know, wasn't a success initially.
Yeah.
You weren't happy with the recordings that you were doing.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you went through a phase of thinking, God, I've invested such a long period of my life, yeah. 500 quid from my aunt wasted. And here I am, and it's not happening. So what?
Yeah, well, I was in trouble. And basically the manager had to go because he was a madman, bless him. I mean, you know, his intentions had been fantastic, but it wasn't working. I was spent a fortune with EMI, with Parlophone. Great Dave Ambrose, A&R man. They were so supportive. EMI were always fantastic, right? The Barrows. And then I thought, right, I've got to do something. I'm on my last. So what had happened is this version of the Target Practice you heard had been mixed by Michael Barbiero and Steve Thompson in New York. And I'd gone over there and I said, look, I'm in real trouble. My album's not worked. I've spent 10 years getting here. It's rubbish. It's not what I wanted. And they said, well, I know what we could do. This is how it should sound. And it was just amazing. suddenly I was with people who were positive, and I said, well, I've got to persuade EMI. So I came back to London, and that's when I put my persuading cap on to persuade Dave Ambrose to let me go to New York and record a song, a single. And that it was Imagination, but...
But that persuasion then was money. You had to get money out of them, or did
it was always about the budget. I mean, at this stage, they'd spent $500,000 by this stage on the album. It was rubbish. I mean, it was just not going anywhere. I mean, bits of it I've salvaged in the end and went back with Steve and Michael. Some people I did myself. No, okay, yeah. So what happened was Dave was like, all right, okay, but make sure it's a hit. So I said, of course it's going to be a hit, Dave. And I always remember the great thing, fax machines. This is a little story. It's absolutely true. In those days, fax machines were new. And I remember that Steve and I said, we've got to make it special, Steve, because, we need an angle. So he said, well, I've met Carlos Alomar and he really wants to work on some stuff we're doing. And I said, OK, great, Carlos Alomar, my hero. But David's Bowie's guitarist and dream guy. And Carlos said, well, I've never worked with Bernard Edwards and Tony Thompson. Of course, I've known Niall for years, but they're in town and they would like to do something. We've never done something together. We've known each other all our lives, right? And so from Chic. So they said, Bernard and Tony. And I came back to London and said, listen, I've got, they were Chic, were pretty big, you know? I mean, and Tony and Tom, and, you know, they were pretty big at the time. And Carlos, so Dave said, all right, we'll make sure it's a hit. Send the budget over. And I always remember the fax came through. This is the funny bit of the story. The fax came through and it was $34,000. It came through to the publishers. So I remember tip-exing out a zero, whacking it off to EMI, all blurred. Do you remember faxes were blurred? $3,400. He said, fantastic. And it's good value too. So I got on the plane, went to New York, did Imagination and Walk Away on a Saturday afternoon, live vocals, got on the plane Sunday evening, came back to EMI Monday morning, said, there's your hit. But what a process. It had taken a long time.
And that's it for part one. In part two, we follow the highlights of Neville or Louis Sum's career and how he dealt with life after he pulled back from the limelight. I'll see you then.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
it's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.